Is that on? Yeah. I was working out fairly recently. It's been almost 25 years since the Lord called me from being an engineer to being a pastor, from fixing machines to working with people. And it's been a privilege beyond description. It's a gift I could never repay. Right through eternity, I'll never be able to thank God for allowing me to be a pastor. It's been very challenging at times, but a lot of the times it's been fun. It's been great fun. And as I thought back in my office a couple of weeks ago when I was writing this message, I thought back over the past 25 years, and a thought struck me, and it's this. During all those years, hundreds of people, probably thousands, have come into my office and said, "Pastor John, I've got a problem. Can we talk?" And the problems have been many, and they've been varied. You name it, people have struggled with it. And yet not once in all those years has someone said to me, "Pastor John, my problem is that I'm just too happy. I go around singing all day. I whistle on my way to work. I'm happy and pleasant with people, even in the post office. Pastor John, I just love all of your sermons. Wish you spoke for longer. I think the worship's great. I even like the plastic chairs. I wake up full of joy, love my family, even like next door's cat. And I go to sleep singing, Pastor John, this has got to stop. I'm just too happy. Would you please pray for me?" It's never happened. I doubt it ever will. And the reason for that is that we live in a world which can often be difficult, challenging, confusing, frightening, troubling, overwhelming, painful, and sometimes dangerous. And when situations like that arise in our life, it can cause us to panic and can cause us to wonder if we've messed up and God's out to get us. I have people ask me that question periodically. Is God out to get me because so many things have gone wrong in my life? It can cause us to wonder if we've failed so badly that we can we ever be restored again? I have people ask me that question. It can cause us to wonder if we've committed some unforgivable sin. It can cause us to want to give up. It can cause us to want to run away and hide in some cave somewhere because the darkness just seems so overwhelming. Maybe that's you right now. In this auditorium, or listening on the CD or on the computer. Maybe you're in a cave right now. Maybe you're living in despair. Maybe you just want to give up. Maybe you've come to this church today, just dragged yourself out of bed on a cold winter's morning, you think, "This may be the last time I enter a church building. I just want to give up." Well, let me tell you something, friends. Sometimes God does his best work in caves. Elijah the prophet had a stunning victory against the priest of Baal, and then he ran away and hid in a cave. He wanted his life to end. He was suffering with clinical depression. But God wasn't finished with him, and yet God had still had work for him to do. And Elijah met God in that cave, and God restored him in that cave. David was a shepherd boy in Israel, and he was anointed to be king of Israel. And you would think then his life would go from strength to strength. But David finds himself living in a cave for 10 years. 10 years. Knowing he'd been anointed to be the king of Israel. Most of that time he was abandoned by his friends. Most of that time he was abandoned by his family. Most of that time he was hunted by King Saul. Most of that time his life was on the line. 10 years living in a cave. But God was at work in that cave. And sometimes when things seem most dark, sometimes when things seem most hopeless, it's in those times when God, in his mighty and most mysterious way, is working out things for our good. Do you believe that? The Bible says God works out all things for our good to those that love him. We find that so difficult to accept, though, when things get really tricky, really dark, very difficult. But it happens to be true nonetheless. Either God knows what he's doing or he doesn't. I believe the Bible to be true. I believe God does work out all things for our good. And I want to tell you this morning, the cave is never the end. And we need to hold on to that thought, because any of us can find ourselves in a cave, in a dark place, even the greatest of Christians. confine themselves there. Just consider a man named Paul. Some people consider Paul was the greatest Christian who's ever lived. Maybe he was. Only God knows. He had a spectacular life. He was born around the time of Jesus. He trained as a rabbi and trained under a man named Gamaliel, one of the top preachers, the top teachers. He quickly became a rabbi and he rose through the ranks. He was extremely intelligent, was Paul. He was totally committed to the Jewish faith. Some would say he was fanatical about the faith. And you know, when you think we're in the middle of a series on giving here at the moment, giving of ourselves to God, giving of ourselves to others, I thought about this. If that door suddenly opened and Paul came striding into the church, think about it. St. Paul. He'd probably come right in right now, stand at the front with the microphone and say, why are you doing a series? You're the disciple. Give the Lord your all. He'd probably pick us all up by the scruff of the neck, pitch us out into the streets and just tell us to get on with the mission. Wouldn't he? Paul didn't spend his life lying on some comfy sofa made by DFS watching Sky TV and eating cheesy nachos. He just didn't. He was giving his life to God, to Yahweh, to defending the Jewish faith. No matter the cost, Paul was prepared to pay it. No one and nothing was going to stand in his way. Paul was fearsome and he was feared by all who opposed him. And then Jesus comes along. And then Pentecost and a church is born and 3,000 souls become Christians on day one. And the church begins to grow. And Paul and the Pharisees, the religious guys, they're appalled. And they're not going to stand for this. And the temple becomes a no-go area for the new Christian faith. All public spaces do. So the people began to meet in their homes. And Paul begins, and the Pharisees begin to direct their attacks in their homes. And the Bible says these words, but Saul, Paul, began to destroy the church, going from house to house. He dragged them off, both men and women, and put them into prison. Acts 8, verse 3. Can you begin to imagine, friends, the terror of religious leaders and soldiers bursting into your house, dragging you off to prison? And remember, this isn't the Roman authorities doing this. This is the religious leaders. This is Paul. This is a man with a mission, and his mission is to destroy a church like this. But the persecution, this going from house to house, this which seemed a smart idea to Paul, it had unintended consequences, because then the church scattered. I grew up in a place called Kirby. Great place. Probably my favorite place in the world, in all truth. I just loved the place. My heart probably still is in Kirby. I live in Aintree. I left my heart in Kirby. Doesn't quite sound the same as San Francisco, but I do. I love it. I'm more at home in Kirby than I am in Aintree. I just am. Because I spent 50 years of my life there. And my dad, he was a really good gardener. Most of you know, knew my dad. He was a really top gardener. And he won an award once for the best kept garden in Knowsley. I've ever told you about this. And somebody put his name in for this award. And he didn't want to do it, but anyway, somebody anonymously put his name in. And he won this award. And one evening, we were all having our tea, and there was a knock on the door. And when we opened the door, it was the Lord Mayor of Knowsley with all councillors and the press. So me, my mum, my dad, my granddad, and my two sisters, we go to the front door. And the Lord Mayor standing there, and he says, congratulations, Jack. You know, you've won the top gardening award of Knowsley. And I said, oh, I didn't even know. You know, I'd entered. So I don't know who put him in. It wasn't one of us. So the Lord Mayor said, well, here's your award. I think it was £20, something like that. A lot of money, about 6 weeks' pay. So my dad gladly takes this money. And then the Lord Mayor says, where would you like the plaque? So my dad says, what plaque? So the Lord Mayor says, well, we've got this nice blue plaque we'd like to put on the side of your house so everybody would know that, you know, you've won the top award. So my dad says, you're not putting that on my wall. So the Lord Mayor said, no, we can put it on the wall some photos. He says, you're not putting it on my wall. As it happens, it wasn't even our house. It was a council house. So they could have painted the house if they'd wanted to. So he says, go on, you can clear it off. And he chased them. Chased them all off. So, anyway, So we kept the £20 and spent it on who knows what. And the plaque never did go up. I used to pull my dad's leg about this for years. But he had this immaculate garden. Anyway, one day when I was about 9 or 10 years old, I was in the garden, and it was a summer's day, and I had in my hand one of those, you know, the stems that you get from dandelions with like a white fluffy thing on top? And I was blowing it. And you know the way all those things come off and they float? Or they were floating all over the garden. And my dad came out the house and he said, "What are you doing, son?" I said, "I'm telling the time, Dad." Do you remember? I said, "You keep blowing these fluffy things and you go, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. I said, "When there's none left, that's the time." This was the days before iPads and computers, by the way. When my dad looked at me and said, "Son, those fluffy things are seeds, and those seeds are weeds. And when those seeds land in the soil, they grow a plant which will grow hundreds more weeds, which we don't want, not in our garden. It doesn't matter if they land in old Tommy's garden, because his garden is like the Amazon jungle, but not here, son. So this is what we do." And he proceeded to take a small plastic bag, put it over the top of the dandelion head, wrap a little tape around it, cut the top off and throw it in the bin. And for over 50 years, that's exactly what I've done. See, it seemed like a good idea at the time to blow all those seeds all over the place, but that would just cause endless problems. And it was the same for Paul 2,000 years ago. The persecution scattered the church far and wide, and it was now near impossible to contain. But Paul was nothing if determined, and so he sets off for Damascus to wreak havoc on the Christians that he's heard are assembling there. But on the road to Damascus, Paul has a vision of Jesus, and his life is spectacularly changed. You know this. Now his passion and zeal is to tell others about Jesus, the Messiah. And of course, people are naturally skeptical. Remember, Paul had been their chief tormentor. But eventually the apostles and the church leaders, they're convinced. And now Paul, the Rabbi Paul, their greatest enemy, becomes their greatest evangelist and missionary. And eventually, after some years, the Christians go to Antioch, a godless city. Read about it. Second most godless city in the Eastern world, after Corinth. And eventually some people become believers. Some of those people were Greeks, Hellenists, and pagans. And the church leaders in Jerusalem, Peter and the others, they get to hear about this. A church has been planted in all places in Antioch. So they send a man named Joseph with a Levite from Cyprus to check out what's happening. They go and find out if this is really true. Now, Joseph's nickname was Barnabas, which means encourager, son of encouragement. And Barnabas sets off north for Antioch, and he sees that amazing things are happening as the Gentiles are coming to faith in droves. And he looks around and he sees all of these people being added to the church, and he thinks, who can speak effectively to these people? These people are not like Jews who've been converted. These people are godless Gentiles. We need someone who can effectively be the bridge between us and them. Who can do this? And then something tweaks in his memory. And he thinks, I know who can help. Paul. Was it really 10 years ago that young Pharisee met Jesus on the road to Damascus? Didn't Jesus tell him to be a witness to the Gentiles? Didn't I introduce him to the apostles? Was that really 10 years ago? Which it was. And Barnabas thinks, I wonder what happened to him. No one's heard from him for a long time. Where did he live? Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus. I could probably get to Tarsus in about 10 days. So Barnabas decides to go and find that young man who disappeared all those years ago. And the Bible says he went to seek for Paul, Acts 11, verse 25. And the Greek word for see is anazitio. It means to search high and low, up and down. It's only used one other time in the Bible, in the book of Luke, where Luke writes that Mary and Joseph sought diligently for Jesus. And the idea is of a frantic search. A parent searching for a child. And that's what Barnabas did. He looked high and low for Paul, who'd been living in obscurity for 7 to 10 years. So here's the question for you this morning. What happened in those years? What happened in those years? It's what the theologians call the hidden years. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23 to 29 gives you a clear catalogue. Paul writes this: "Are they servants of Christ? I am out of my mind to talk like this. I am more, I've worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I've received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was pelted with stones. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a day and a night in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, in danger from false believers. I've labored and toiled. I've often gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst. I've often gone without food. I've been cold and naked. Beside everything else, I could face daily the pressure of my concern for all of the churches. Who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn?" That's quite a life. It's quite a life. And most of those things happened in those hidden years. You say you've had a tough life? Tell me about it, Paul would say. In those years, Paul found himself in real trouble. He received 39 lashes 5 times. And receiving 39 lashes was the most severe penalty that could be given by a synagogue court apart from stone. And 5 times Paul had been stripped and his back lashed, 195 lashes in total. Imagine what that would do to your back, Mal. Or you, Marco. Ken. Imagine that what it would do to your back. And why 39 lashes? Because someone had worked out that 40 lashes might kill you. Amazing. 39 was as close as they could get without killing you. A public lashing was also given as a sign of excommunication from the synagogue. Paul had been excommunicated from his people on 5 separate occasions, and excommunication meant you became a non-Jew. Paul had also run into the Roman authorities 2 times. The lictors who stood behind the Roman magistrates with great bundles of rods were the administrators of Roman justice. You know when we say Liverpool licked Everton yesterday? You know when we say we use that term? That's where it comes from the time of Paul. And the Roman magistrates, I was in Ephesus a week yesterday, and we were in the Praetorium where the Roman authorities would gather. And the magistrate's chair, I sat on the magistrate's chair, it's still there. And when the magistrate would stand there, either side of him would stand 2 Roman guards, and they would stand with great bundles of rods. And if you were found guilty of a crime, the magistrate would give order to these 2 guys, and they would take these bundles of rods, and they would take the prisoner, and they would tie you publicly in the public square, which is still there in Ephesus. They would tie you down naked, and they would lash you with these rods. That's happened to Paul. They would lay the prisoner down, take off his garments, beat the prisoner on his legs and back with the rod. They would flay the skin, open great wounds, sometimes break bones. And when they took off Paul's garments and saw the previous scars, they will almost certainly have thought, this man's a troublemaker. He's obviously not learned his lesson. Well, he will this time, and his beating will have been even more severe. You know, I want to tell you this morning, it cost Paul to be a follower of Jesus Christ. What's it costing you and me? An hour in church of a Sunday? Maybe small group if you want to turn up. Prayers if you can find a time. Bible reading if you're in trouble. Using your gifts, time, and talents, and finance for the King. What's it costing you and me to be a disciple of Jesus? It cost Paul everything, literally everything. After his time in Jerusalem, he went back to his hometown of Tarsus. He just became too toxic. The apostles sent him away. He goes back to Tarsus, which is in Turkey. He almost certainly will have preached in his local synagogue. He almost certainly will have been excommunicated from his local synagogue, which meant that no one would speak to him. He wouldn't be allowed to buy and sell in his home. He became a non-person. He was anathema in his hometown. His family will have abandoned him. Of that you can be certain. You can be just as certain that his wife will have divorced him during this time. Paul was almost certainly married. It's almost inconceivable that a Pharisee would be given the task of the kind of responsibility given to Paul in persecuting the church if he were not married. It almost would never have happened. So when Barnabas came to look for Paul, keep this clearly in your mind. When Barnabas walked from Antioch to Tarsus, when he came to look for Paul, his family had abandoned him, his wife was gone, and his children too. Everyone who knew him counted him as dead. We know he tried to plant churches during that period. It appears he had next to no success. Paul is broken and beaten, and for him life is very dark. And maybe also for you this day. And you're wondering, well, now what? Is this it? Is this it till the day I die? And maybe you're in a cave, a dark place. Well, the early church fathers tell us that Barnabas found Paul living in a cave in the Taurus Mountains in southern Turkey. So where else is Paul going to live? He's hated by most and shunned by the rest. He's living like a hermit in a cave, out of reach of those who want to do him harm. And he's been in that cave for years, up to 10 years. And all the while wondering just what had happened to the mission that God had given him on the road to Damascus. Due to the many beatings, Paul's legs will have been bandy. They will have bent outwards. He was stooped and bent over, not even able to straighten his back. This is common amongst those who suffered the systematic tortures that Paul had suffered. The scar tissue on his back would heal after the previous beating, only to be ripped open with the next whipping, creating a scar tissue that built up and warped his back with each successive beating. For a picture, think of Quasimodo. I don't know what you thought Paul looked like before today. But if he came through that door now, you would see a man whose body was broken. Paul would need to strain his neck just to make eye contact with you to compensate for the back-bending 60-degree angle. He was stooped over. When I was growing up, there was a lad in our road who was about 3 or 4 years older than me. I'll call him Terry. We'd sometimes play football together. He was okay with Terry. I liked him. Liked him a great deal. And when I was about 15, Terry went to the Isle of Man for a holiday. And when he was there, he got into some bother and he ended up in court. He was sentenced to 6 strokes of the birch and 6 months in a youth detention centre. A few days after he turned home, I was sitting on the wall outside of our house and Teddy came walking down the road on the other side. And as he passed, he looked over and he waved and said, "Hiya, John." And I said, "Hiya, Terry." And he kept on walking. And although that was 50 years ago, what I remember was that Terry seemed to be stooped over. He was a very tall lad and it was very noticeable. Was that the birch that did it? Who knows? What we do know is that when Barnabas walked into that cave in the Taurus Mountains, Paul was no older than 43 years old. But he had a string of apparent failures, no family, no wife, no children, few of any friends, and a broken, failing body living in a cave. In every way you look at it, Paul seems to be a failure. Maybe he'd given up. Seriously, maybe he'd given up. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? For most of us, that would be mission over. But then Barnabas shows up, thank God. Imagine that moment. Barnabas shows up. And he goes into Paul's cave and he says, son, it's happening, it's really happening. All that you had on your heart in that day on the road to Damascus, it's happening. Gentiles are coming to faith, many of them, even in Antioch, that most godless of cities. Paul, we need you. The Lord needs you. It's not over, Paul. It's barely begun. Come on. Let's go. And though stooped and bowed and broken and bow-legged, Paul followed Barnabas back into the harvest. And Paul discovered that his best years were ahead of him, discovered that the tears he'd shed had watered the seeds of faith, discovered that the kingdom on earth was growing, discovered that God had not abandoned him, discovered that God was still at work, discovered that God still is at work in a cave. I think it's magnificent. So what about you as we close? What about you? Was there once a day when your passion for God was white hot? All of you. Was there once a day when your passion for God was so hot you would rise early in the morning to read his word? Was there once a day when your passion for God was so white hot that you couldn't wait to tell others about him? Was there once a day when your passion for God was so white hot you actually believed your prayers were being heard in heaven? Was there once a day when the Bible was so alive that prayer was a joy, serving was a privilege, telling others about Jesus was as natural as breathing? Was there once a day when the mission for Jesus really mattered and just the mention of his name made your heart miss a beat? Was there once such a day? Was there once a day when the King and his kingdom were more than just words in church of a Sunday? Was there once such a day for you? But now you feel like you're in a cave, cold and dark and purposeless and hopeless. Well, let me do what Barnabas did for Paul and say, it's not over. It's not over. This is not all there is. The Lord has need of every single one of you in this place. Every one of you. No exceptions. There's much to be done. The fields are white unto harvest, and God is calling you to join him in his work. All of you. Yeah? No exceptions. All of you. And he has brought you to this place today to say, come on, it's time to leave the cave today. Today. Though battered and bruised, Paul said yes, and the rest is history. And one day you will meet him, and he will fill in the blanks. And when you look into his eye, I want you to have a story to tell as well. And so does God. Come out the cave, friends. That's not where you're supposed to be living any longer. Come out the cave, God says. And you remember, the cave is not the end. Just ask David, just ask Elijah, just ask Paul. Even better, just ask Jesus.